This is WBOY Presents. I'm Sean Beter. Earlier this week, NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers visited Fort Wayne to give a lecture about the Middle East and her career as a war correspondent. I had the opportunity to sit down with McEvers to talk about her experiences, and I started by asking her about her upbringing in Illinois and her first taste of journalism at her college newspaper. Let's hear the interview.
My first assignment was something about housing regulations and how they were going to affect availability in Section 8 housing units. And I spent like 2 days reporting it. It was like a very simple news story. I spent tons of time. I went and like lived in the homeless shelter to see how people are going to be affected and like interviewed like tons of people. And eventually the story was on the front page. And then, you know, when I finally got around to writing it and that was it. I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
How do you go, though, from reporting on Section 8 or from the Metro desk, was it at the Chicago Tribune?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do you go from there to I want to be a foreign correspondent, I want to go to dangerous places?
Right. Well, part of it has to do maybe with growing up in a small town and never having really gone anywhere. So maybe that's part of it, I think. But when you work at a newspaper like the Chicago Tribune, which at the time was in the 90s, was one of the country, perhaps the world's great newspapers. And your idols, the people who are really doing the work that stands out, are the foreign correspondents. There was a correspondent at the time. I remember because I remember her byline. Her name was Liz Sly. And she was just doing riveting work from Africa and the Middle East. She ended up being a colleague of mine later in Syria. I mean, we were both covering the same thing. And I was always just like pinching myself, like, I can't believe this actually happened, that I was, you know, in the same world as Liz Sly, because she was somebody I looked up to. And my boss at one time had also been a foreign correspondent. And so his stories of, I mean, the sense that you were there when history was happening, you were literally like writing the first chapter of history, that just sounded really cool to a kid from a small town in central Illinois.
So what was your first foreign assignment?
So my boss, who had been a foreign correspondent, and other people who advised me along the way, had always said, you know, if you want to be a foreign correspondent, you know, one way to do it is to just go be one. You know, I could have waited my turn at the newspaper. I wasn't the only one who wanted to be a foreign correspondent. Like, everybody at the newspaper wanted to be a foreign correspondent. And so,
why do you think that is?
Because it's cool. You know, I mean, because your name's on the front page. I mean, the part of it is the kind of, you're doing the best work at the paper, that somehow it's more important to be documenting the atrocities in Bosnia than it is to go to the city council meeting. I don't think that's true, but I think that's a perception, especially among young journalists. Like, wow, look at that. That's got to be more exciting than going to the Schomburg city council meeting or whatever. especially somebody who I just had never really traveled and never been anywhere except for, you know, like the little, you know, Eurail trip around Europe for a couple of months backpacking. And so instead of waiting my turn to be a foreign correspondent, which may have never happened at a newspaper that great. I mean, the competition was stiff. I was like, maybe, you know, if I wait around for 15 years, I'll get a chance. Maybe I won't. So it's kind of like, maybe I should just try to go. So I found out about this little newspaper called the Cambodia Daily, based in Phnom Penh, a place that, you know, was real in my memory in terms of my parents growing up during and being very active and alive during the Vietnam War. And I wrote to the publisher and said, hey, I don't know if you have any jobs available. And he said, well, why don't you come meet me in New York? And I said, oh, New York, I'm going to be in New York this weekend, which totally wasn't true and made it sound like I'll just happen to, yeah, sure, stop by. And we were 5 minutes into the conversation when he offered me a job. And I said, yes, I will take that job. And then left the meeting and called my parents to tell them, I think I just took a job in Cambodia.
What did they have to say?
They were like, okay. And then the conversation at the newspaper was really interesting because, you know, everybody was like, you were making such a huge mistake. You're leaving this great, great, great newspaper. You know, now I look back and I look at what's happened to newspapers, especially the Tribune, which has been bought and sold so many times, and all the great, not all the great journalists, many of the great journalists have left. And I think, whew, you know, but I certainly didn't think of it that way. I was just acting on a whim, and I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it now. I'm 29 years old. I'm not married. I don't have any kids. I've, you know, got a couple of bucks saved. Why not take a huge pay cut and move to Cambodia. And so
naturally, like any 29-year-old would.
Totally. And my boss at the time, I remember so well, the one who had been a foreign correspondent, I remember telling him and he just jumped for joy. He was so excited. And that's when it started. It was 1999. I took a job at this newspaper and it was New Year's Eve 2000. The BBC correspondent in Phnom Penh was going on a temporary assignment to Korea and she needed somebody to fill in for her. And she was like, does anybody around here, she was saying to a crowd of journalists, know radio? And I was like, well, I sort of do. I knew how to cut tape. I'd been on This American Life once, which didn't really mean that I knew how to do radio, but I knew something. And she's like, okay, great, you're going to fill in for me. And then all of a sudden, I just sort of got thrust into being the freelance fill-in correspondent for the BBC World Service in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Wow.
I was terrible. I mean, I was really bad at radio. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. But then the phone kind of started ringing off the hook because this is the BBC World Service, 24 hours a day, radio news. They had a lot of shows to fill. And so then they flew me. They offered to fly me to London to actually train me on how to be a radio reporter for, I think it was a week or 2 weeks. They gave me a microphone. They taught me how to cut tape. They taught me how to write, you know, news dispatches, as they call them. And they taught me how to pronounce Kofi Annan instead of Kofi Annan, to say schedule instead of schedule and all this stuff.
Did they really teach you that?
That's really told me that.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so, like, I had this crash course in how to do radio. And then they were like, okay, off you go. And I just started filing stories left and right.
Our listeners will know from hearing your coverage elsewhere that, I mean, you didn't stay in
right.
Cambodia. Can you trace the path for us a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. So that was I left in 2000, came back to the States a little bit, but then I really, really liked reporting in Southeast Asia. So after 9/11, I started in Indonesia, which is the world's most populous Muslim country, and thought maybe I can get a handle on this here. And maybe someday, eventually, all roads will lead to the Middle East, which, of course, they did. I took a detour in the former Soviet Union, reporting in the Muslim republics there for a couple of years. But by 2008, I was still freelancing, but I had stationed myself in Saudi Arabia, where, again, you have to always be looking at where is their interest, where will editors be interested to take stories, but where there's not a whole lot of competition. There weren't a whole lot of journalists who wanted to be based in Saudi Arabia, so I chose that. So ended up there in 2008, and so began the odyssey of my time in the Middle East.
You mention in the documentary that we've played on this station before, Diary of a Bad Year, that folks who are covering the Middle East, you call them the tribe.
Mm.
That's a very specific term. What makes that breed of journalist tribal? What makes
it's funny.
Foreign correspondents who they are?
I think in that context, it's more kind of conflict correspondence than it is necessarily people in the Middle East. So I think it's a generation of, you know, depending on when you got into the game, you might be somebody who covered Bosnia, you might be somebody who covered Chechnya, and then ultimately you had to at some point have done some time in Iraq or Afghanistan, the wars that our generation knows. And then later, of course, you know, the Arab uprisings that later turned into conflicts, things like Libya and Yemen and ultimately Syria. So, you know, when you're in those really intense situations, you become really close really fast with people because we really cling to each other. And so, yeah, we feel it when somebody gets hurt.
Let's talk about the last few years in the Middle East and maybe start with the Arab Spring. Can you tell us a little bit about your travels over that period of time? This was spring 2011.
Right. I was based in Baghdad, and NPR at the time had a really pretty strict policy that we were never going to miss a day of covering Baghdad. We had American soldiers in that country, and our radio network was going to cover it.
And this was before the official end of
The American troop presence there. I mean, I think the quote-unquote war was over. American troops had been pulled back into their bases, but they were still based in Iraq, and they were, you know, largely playing a train and assist role, as they would tell you. But every once in a while, they got engaged in some skirmishes, and we would report on that. But then, you know, late 2012 when a guy named Bouazizi set himself on fire in Tunisia, and the whole world changed, and I was, you know, my job was to sit in Baghdad because that was our mandate. But man, all the correspondents, the tribes started clearing out. People started, you know, deploying to Tunisia. Then they started rising up in Egypt and Yemen and Bahrain. And, you know, I mean, there were just not hardly enough correspondents to keep up. But there I sat, twiddling my thumbs in Baghdad, waiting, watching it all on TV, just saying, writing notes to my editor, put me in, coach. You know, I mean, they weren't taking any stories from Iraq. So, you know, eventually I got put into the game because we simply just had no, we ran out of bodies to cover all these uprisings.
What was it like to be an English language reporter in American reporter among those crowds?
It depended on where you were. So like if you were in Egypt, and I didn't do the big ones. I didn't do Egypt and Libya because, again, I was sort of the low man on the totem pole. I was like the last one in. And so by the time I started covering the Arab Springs, my joke is that I covered all the ones that didn't work. So you've got people celebrating in Egypt, eventually celebrating in Libya, though it took a long time. And now, I'm not so sure there was a lot to celebrate about, but celebrating in Tunisia. I would go to places like Yemen, Bahrain, and Syria, where the uprisings were very much put down by the governments and put down very violently, and where journalists were seen as the enemy because journalists were coming to tell the story of the protests, and that was not the story that the government wanted to hear. So among the people, you were seen as an ally, right? Among the protesters, you were seen as an ally, but by the government, you were seen as an enemy. And so, I mean, I snuck in. I snuck into Bahrain. I snuck into Yemen. I pretended to be just a civilian. I went to Bahrain without any recording equipment. I just used my iPhone because I was on a business visa, sort of posing as just sort of a, I don't know, a businesswoman, whatever that means. When you're out of protest, you're sort of seen as, again, like an ally. So you're sort of on friendly territory. It's all the rest of the time that you have to be careful. I never had a phone conversation on the telephone. It was only on Skype. Like, I mean, there were huge precautions we took to not just for my own safety, but for the safety of the people I was talking to. I mean, that was my biggest concern, right? I mean, there was this one woman who'd been put in prison, beaten up, and in order to tell me her story, she could only do it in English and at a whisper because she was so afraid that they would recognize her voice. I mean, and it was one of those times where you're like, oh, no, that's not going to sound very good. But it ended up being one of the most powerful radio stories I've ever done, to hear some woman whispering about the beatings they'd given her simply for going out to be a protester, to protest in the streets.
Did you encounter a lot of that reticence, I guess, among the folks you talked to, especially in the places where governments were cracking down?
Yeah, of course. I mean, oh, the stories I could tell. But there's a couple in Syria, you know, just to go out and see a protest. One night I had to arrange it by Skype. And then the instructions were, you know, get out at this corner, get a taxi to this place, get out, get another taxi to this place, get out, get another taxi to this place, stand in front of this embassy for 10 minutes. We'll drive by, make sure no one's following you. Then you will be approached by a contact who will whisper instructions in your ear, follow him to a parking lot. I mean, it was that detailed in order to make sure they were not being followed, because protesters in Syria, I mean, you get shot, you get detained, you get tortured, sometimes to death. I mean, this was no joke. You know what I mean? Getting caught protesting in Syria was no joke. So we took huge precautions to protect them. That said, there were times when I would be in the middle of a protest and a guy who, you know, with his face covered because he didn't want authorities to recognize who he was, would come up and drop a thumb drive in my pocket and say, "We've got no internet, we've got no electricity. On this thumb drive are the pictures and the videos of what's really happening. Please tell the world our story." And I would be telling him, "Don't talk to me. You're putting yourself in danger." It's the first time in my whole career as a journalist where I'm telling someone not to talk to me.
That's amazing.
Yeah, no, it was just harrowing.
I want to talk more about Syria and your time there in a minute, but I want to get back to the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. What do you think the legacy of the Arab Spring has been? You know, a lot of folks who have been paying attention over here, probably less than overwhelmed with the results. You know,
sure.
Early on, we were talking about a fully democratic Middle East.
Oh, boy, the promise and the hope of those days. Look, Tunisia's looking okay. Tunisia, you know, it's messy. There's this great study done recently, or they've updated the study recently, looking at if you overthrow a government with nonviolently, your likelihood of success of sort of installing a government in a nonviolent fashion is pretty high. And I think we're going to see that in Tunisia. I think it's looking pretty and Tunisia. Yemen is Yemen, and it's complicated, and I could go on forever about Yemen. And they did, you know, somebody tried to assassinate the leader, but he did end up leaving power without sort of a violent coup. It's in the process of this massive national dialogue, and there's all kinds of factions, and there's tons of fighting. Just yesterday, it looked really bad. But it's one of those things that may or may not be on its way. Again, super messy. Obviously, places like Syria, Egypt, and Libya, because the overthrow was violent, or in Egypt's case involved, you know, sort of the compliance of the military. In some ways, it was a soft coup, right? It wasn't a real revolution from the streets. It's not pretty. I mean, it's just not pretty. Is that to say that these people should have never gone into the streets? I mean, yeah, so there's some Syrians who would say that. But the numbers don't lie in the Middle East. You still got way more, you know, something like two-thirds to three-quarters of the population that is under the age of 30. I mean, you've just got this exploding youth population. You have these outdated dictators that could not provide for them, that didn't have the jobs, did not have the economic opportunity for them. Something's going to have to give. You know, these old ways of ruling these countries is not going to work. The more brutal you are, the more people are going to respond. Now you throw religion into that mix, you throw sects and ethnic groups into that mix, and now, of course, you throw Islamist militants into that mix, and it's super ugly and combustible. But I would never in a million years say we should go back to the way it was, because that wasn't working.
Especially during, you know, the Iraq War 2003-2004, you know, we saw a lot of reporters, you know, embedded with U.S. military units. You didn't report that way.
No.
It seems anyway like you were largely on your own, or maybe occasionally with a producer or an editor. But what's it like to be on the ground in that way?
Well, by the time I got to Iraq in 2010, there were hardly really any embeds to do. By the time I got there, I could just dress up like an Iraqi woman, cover my hair, cover my clothes with a robe, depending on which part of the country. I went to every single corner of that country. I was able to tell Iraqi stories about the Iraqi experience of the war. It was like I was almost retelling the war over and over again. And yeah, I just worked alone because, I mean, there was just, again, all our resources were deployed elsewhere, and I really liked it. So by the time Syria happened, you know, again, I started covering it like an Arab uprising, and it took a long time, I think, for all of us to realize this is a civil war. You know, so I found that when I did, the times I did go into Syria, I mean, it was that in some ways it was a lot safer to go with fewer people. It was a lot safer to go looking like a local, and it was something that I knew how to do from Iraq. And so we tried really hard to figure out how to take as few people as possible, you know, enough people to be safe, but few enough people where we could just sort of blend in, be respectful, do the story, and then get out before we got hurt.
Well, you were covering Syria during the height of the fighting. This was 2012,
yeah.
Around that time.
Yeah.
You actually had to sneak into the country.
Right. So, yeah.
How does one do that? I mean,
well,
in the middle of a civil war when the borders are ostensibly closed.
Right.
And you're an American reporter crossing the border.
So the Syrian government would very rarely give visas to journalists, very, very rarely. And they would pick and choose who they would give visas to. They gave me a visa once and only once. And because I reported on protests while I was there on that visa, they would never give me a visa again because even though I reported both sides of the story, they just decided that was it for me. So the way we did it at NPR was my colleague, Deborah Amos, she would get visas and she would go into Damascus, the capital, and tell the story from that perspective. And then I would embed sort of with the rebels who were starting to take territory in the north of the country along the Turkish border. So what they would do is they took over border crossings eventually. And so you could cross like at a regular border crossing with your passport, and the rebels would stamp your passport. It wasn't the Syrian government anymore, it was the rebels. Before that, we crossed like, you know, in the middle of the night through a potato field. People crossed by water. I climbed a mountain once to cross over into the border. I actually climbed a mountain out of Syria once with while I was being chased.
Wait, hold on. No, we can't go on from that. While you were being chased by whom?
Actually, by Turkish border officials. The Turks, like, sort of turned a blind eye for us. They knew we were crossing. They knew refugees were crossing. They knew journalists were crossing. But sometimes they would shake you down for money. And once I had an iPhone stolen by Turkish border guards, other times they would try to make a show of stopping you and threatening you. So, I mean, we knew we weren't going to get, you know, shot or anything, but they were definitely sort of chasing us down as we were crossing the border into Turkey.
This is going to sound like a strange question, but what do you take with you on a sneaky border crossing into a civil war?
Lots of batteries. You take body armor. You take it's a vest kind of thing that you put over your head, and it has these huge, really heavy metal plates that protect your vital organs in front and back. And then there's like these big Velcro things that you wrap around your sides. There's plates on the sides too. A helmet. For, you know, if you're in a firefight situation, you're not wearing that because, you know, if you're crossing the border, you're not really necessary unless you start hearing shots or something. You take some kind of GPS device in case you get left behind or lost so you can try to figure your way out. You take lots of Clif bars. You take lots of pens.
Like energy bars.
Pens and notebooks. You take really sturdy hiking boots. For me, I would take a head scarf and sort of a long coat so I could blend in and look like a local. Though the first time I went in, it was hotter than Hades. So you can't wear a coat, but I had like these long sort of loose cotton shirts that I could then put a head scarf on with. And I would look as much like a local as possible, although usually not. And then what you do is you take, interpreter. I speak some Arabic, but definitely not enough to do my job. So, and my colleague who worked for NPR, who was Syrian, she would always come with me, and she was great. And so she was an interpreter. She recorded. She was like a producer. She was a fixer. She set up she was sort of an every person. And then we also took what's known as a security advisor, which is somewhere between a medic and a bodyguard. And this is usually someone from who's formally formerly with the British special forces, so who now work for these companies that provide security support to media companies. And so they would be there to, a lot of times, you know, to be a medic. If somebody were to get injured, they were, you know, it's like having a paramedic. They were very good at extraction. So if you did get lost, they could use that GPS and figure out how to get you the heck out of a bad situation. They were very good at weapons. So when a helicopter was flying overhead, firing rounds, they could tell, is this incoming, is it outgoing, how far away is it, what where should we hide. That actually happened. So, you know, those are the kind of the key elements that you would take in.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about that instance?
We're in the middle of a town. I was that first trip in. Was that the first trip? Right, because we crossed the potato field. Yeah, that was the first trip in, and we sort of decided it was very, you know, it was like, it was clear to everybody, summer 2012, this is a civil war, you know. Some journalists had been killed in the city of Homs, like, and we knew. This wasn't peaceful protesters anymore. These are people who had picked up arms and decided to fight against the Syrian government and use guns to do it. And there was a rebel group forming loosely, you know, under the umbrella of the Free Syrian Army. And so we're like, who are these guys? And so some journalists had started crossing over, you know, the border to spend time with them. And so we thought we would do it too. And so we decided to go in for like a week or 10 days. And we were in this town that had been, quote unquote, liberated by the rebels. So, you know, the rebels would come into these villages, and whatever vestiges of the government was left would either flee, would either say, oh, we surrender, we're with you, or would fight their way out. And so this little town was controlled by the rebels, and it was kind of a rebel base. And from that town, they would go out, they would ride out sort of at night and go fight along the front lines against the government a little bit further away. So this town was nominally pretty safe. But right while we were there, the Syrian Air Force decided to use its air power to kind of push them back. And one of the first days they were doing that, there was a helicopter gunship over the village firing, you know, firing at the rebels outside of the village, but it looked like it was coming, you know, right for us. And we were right in the middle of downtown, broad daylight. And so my security advisor at the time, whose nickname was Bunny.
Yeah, Bunny.
Long story. he's a very big guy, very strong, smart guy, and just, you know, told me where he's like, if he starts flying in this direction and firing in this way, you jump over there behind that concrete wall and you hit the dirt and you put your face down and you put your hands over your head and you hide there. Didn't happen. But that's the kind of conversations you have.
Not the conversations we're having here.
No, I guess
generally.
Not. Yeah, I guess those are, yeah. Those are one of those times where you're like, is this really happening? I never saw myself as a war correspondent. It was never my aim to be a war correspondent. I wanted to be overseas. I was very interested in telling the stories of people, of human beings living through things. Something like the Arab Spring is something that you cannot imagine. It is a major upheaval that comes along once in a lifetime for the people living it and for the journalists covering it. It was the story of a lifetime. It was just, it was a story unlike any other thing. And so when you start to get wrapped up in a story like this and telling people's stories, you can't then just be like, oh, wait, this is starting to look like a war. Gotta go. I'm, you know, like I was just, it was very slow the way you get drawn in. You know, I wanted to see how the people were living. I wanted to know what was going on with the people. And it was like, well, to understand what the people are going through, they're getting fired on by helicopters. I need to do it too so I can understand it. I mean, that's how you justify it, at least.
Are there any moments from your time, from that time in Syria, that stay with you, that will always be there? I'm sure there are many, but
so many. There was a funeral. It was early on. I don't know if it was on the same trip. No, it was, we had come back. And there's this place that you entered into Syria from Turkey. And so it was this kind of village that became familiar to us because every time we came in through this town. And I remember it had been relatively safe. And the thinking was it was because it was nestled into this little triangle of land that was basically surrounded on three sides by Turkish territory. There was a sense that it was safe, you know, that Turkey was sort of like, you know, informally taken care of it, you know. And so the helicopters, the warplanes didn't fly over that part of Syria. And then one time we were there, there was a skirmish and one of the guys from that village was killed. And it was really hard for the village. It was really, really hit them hard. And we went to the funeral and there were men and women sort of mourned separately, men on one side of the house and women on the other side of the house. So, of course, we went in to be with the women, which is one of the great things about being a woman covering the Middle East, because you get to access everybody. I can interview the men and I can interview the women, whereas a male colleague couldn't always do that. And we sat with them, and I remember them telling me, don't tell me about your son. Who was he? What kind of guy was he? And, you know, they were asking me, well, what is America doing about this? Why aren't you? And I said, look, I don't work for the government. This isn't my job. I can tell you what I know from news reports about American policy on Syria and why it's so difficult. And I just remember this woman looking at me and saying, you know, we're not going to forget. We're not going to forget that you forgot about us.
We'll be back in a moment with the second half of an interview with NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers. You're listening to WBOY Presents.